Hello, my name is Dave Emery. This is For the Record program number 339, titled Walking the Snake, Part 4, being recorded on December 2nd of 2001. This is a half hour in length. The title, like the other three Walking the Snake programs before it, is a reference to the Nazi tract Serpent's Walk, published by National Vanguard Books and authored by someone who writes under the name of Randolph D. Calverhall. That book is about a Nazi takeover of the United States in the mid-21st century by the descendants of the Third Reich, literally a Third Reich gone underground. The Nazi SS and the Third Reich go underground in this, quote, novel, unquote, build up their economic muscle, buy into the American opinion-forming media, then they infiltrate the United States Army, or at the same time they infiltrate the U.S. military and intelligence community, and after a massive bioterror attack on the United States, which wipes out a lot of the American population, the underground Reich takes over the United States. As I've stated before, I believe that just like the Turner Diaries, also purportedly a novel and also published by National Vanguard Books, I believe that Serpent's Walk is in fact far more than the novel it purports to be. I believe that it is a blueprint, a manifesto for what the underground Reich and the worldwide Nazi movement, both inside and outside of the United States, is in fact doing. I've done many broadcasts, which touch on the book Serpent's Walk, and I believe that the Serpent's Walk scenario is in fact being realized, yea, verily, even as we speak. Bearing in mind a couple of major features about the book Serpent's Walk, after going underground, after buying into the American opinion-forming media, the underground Reich, the descendants of the SS, or the SS in future generations, infiltrate the United States Army and intelligence community, and after a bioterror attack on the United States, which leads to the declaration of martial law, they take over the United States. And perhaps veteran or sager listeners can perhaps see why I believe that this book is far more than the novel it purports to be. To make a long story short, I believe that Serpent's Walk is the Turner Diaries for the Bormann Organization and the Underground Reich. And I've spoken about the Bormann Organization in many programs. Those are available from a tape and CD duplication service called Spitfire, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005, email mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. The website for Spitfire is www.spitfirelist.com. Spitfirelist is one word, SPITFIRELIST.com, and it is equipped with real audio. There are detailed, annotated descriptions of all of the programs about September 11th, For the Record programs number 325 through 339 that I'm recording now, and they will be up on the web by the time listeners hear this program. The For the Record programs are also being archived on real audio by sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey. More recent programs streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery. There are older programs, including the vast bulk of the For the Record programs, available for download only on real audio on another WFMU website that has links both on the WFMU.org/Dave Emery website and on the Spitfire website from the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. Now, bearing in mind the Serpent's Walk scenario in which, among other things, the underground Reich, before taking over the United States in the mid-21st century, infiltrates the United States Army, then there's a massive bioterror attack on the United States, martial law is declared, and they take over. Consider the following from the San Francisco Chronicle of Sunday, December 2nd of 2001. That's today, as this program is being recorded. This is a New York Times story by William J. Broad and Judith Miller, headlined, FBI Expands Anthrax Probe to Federal Labs. The FBI has expanded its investigation of the anthrax attacks to include the laboratories of the government and its contractors as a possible source of the anthrax that has infected and killed five people, say scientists and law enforcement officials. While theories about the culprit have focused mainly on domestic loners and foreign states or terrorists, law enforcement officials are now also examining the possibility that the criminal may be a knowledgeable insider. asked if the FBI was investigating U.S. military and non-military laboratories that held the anthrax strain used in the attacks and individuals associated with such centers, a law enforcement official replied, quote, certainly, unquote. Skipping down, Colonel Arthur M. Friedlander, the senior research scientist at the Army's Biodefense Laboratory at Fort Detrick, Maryland, said officials there were cooperating with federal investigators. Quote, they've asked us about personnel who had access, unquote, Friedlander said, again quoting, they didn't talk to me about my personal experience. They asked me about other personnel, unquote. Skipping down again, separately, a private expert in biological weapons, Barbara Hatch Rosenberg, has recently published a paper contending that a government insider or someone in contact with an insider is behind the lethal attacks. Law enforcement officials said Rosenberg's assertion might turn out to be well-founded, though they emphasized that the investigation was still broad-based. One official close to the federal investigation called the Rosenberg theory, quote, the most likely hypothesis, unquote. Rosenberg, who is chairwoman of an arms control panel at the Federation of American Scientists, a private group in Washington, noted a conclusion reached by some experts knowledgeable about the investigation. The anthrax powder in the letters floated easily, which demanded sophisticated treatment of the kind used in the old U.S. offensive program. Quote, all the available information, she said, again quoting, is consistent with a U.S. government lab as the source, either of the anthrax itself or of the recipe for the U.S. weaponization process, unquote, Rosenberg, for the U.S. weaponization process, unquote. Rosenberg contended that the anthrax used in the attacks either originated in the U.S. weapons program or was made by someone who had learned the secret recipe. The killer, Rosenberg concludes, is, quote, an American microbiologist who had or once had access to weaponized anthrax in a U.S. government lab or had been taught by a U.S. defense expert how to make it. Perhaps he had a vial or two in his basement as a keepsake, unquote. By the way, I would note in that connection, for the record, programs 317 and 319 dealing with connections between right-wing and fascist extremists and the Project Coast apartheid-era South Africa biological weapons program. One wonders whether perhaps some of those toys have escaped. But again, note the Serpent's Walk scenario in which the underground Reich infiltrates the U.S. military. After a bioterror attack, martial law is declared, and they take over the United States. I would note that one of the major critics of the draconian restrictions on civil liberties that have taken place in the United States under the auspices of Attorney General John Ashcroft, one of the major critics has been Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont, and he also was the target of one of the anthrax attacks. By the way, the subtitle for the record program number 339 is Ashcroft Uber Alles. The full title of the program, Walking the Snake Part 4, Ashcroft Uber Alles. And Ashcroft himself has some very interesting connections and past liaisons, as we will review later in the program. The following article is from the San Jose Mercury News of Sunday, December 2nd of the year 2001. This is also a New York Times story by Robin Toner. It's headlined, Power Struggle Over Civil Liberties, subtitled Tensions Rising Between Senator and Attorney General. It's datelined Washington and reads in part as follows. In an interview, speaking of Senator Patrick Leahy, Leahy, a former prosecutor from Vermont and a 25-year veteran of the Senate, said, quote, I don't want to struggle. First and foremost, as an American and as a Vermonter, I want to see us protected from terrorism. But I want it done in a way that does not diminish the basic protections of the Constitution, unquote. The administration and its allies argue that it has maintained that balance and note that the public is overwhelmingly supportive of its approach, judging from public opinion polls. And they dispute the idea that Ashcroft has failed to adequately consult with Congress. By the way, I would note that many civil liberties experts, many legal professionals, are of the opinion that, in effect, the secret military tribunals, which are going to be used to try terrorist suspects, not to mention some of the rapidly restricting liberty limits on surveillance, are rapidly hurtling us towards, that's right, martial law. The following article is from the San Francisco Chronicle of Sunday, November 25th of the year 2001. Although the martial law, the secret tribunals, the military tribunals to try terrorist suspects, and although the relaxed restrictions on surveillance, which are being relaxed, yea, verily, even as I speak, even though those have received a fair amount of coverage, what has not received a great deal of coverage are the provisions being made for, that's right, a massive bioterror attack on the United States, and for lack of a better term, this plan might be termed bio-martial law. Again, from the Chronicle of Sunday, November 25th of the year 2001, this is an article by Bernadette Tansey, T-A-N-S-E-Y, of the Chronicle. It's headlined, Health Bill Jeopardizes Civil Rights, subtitled, Bush Pushes Plan to Expand Control in Bioweapon Attack, and it reads in part as follows. Worried that decades-old public health laws could prevent authorities from battling a 21st-century bioterror plague, the Bush administration is urging states to grant health officials sweeping powers in such an epidemic. The administration wants all 50 states to adopt a law allowing public health authorities to take over hospitals, seize drug supplies, quarantine people exposed to infectious pathogens, draft doctors to treat them, force patients to be vaccinated, and order police to restrain residents from leaving contaminated areas. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention rushed out the proposed legislation at the request of Health and Human Services Secretary Tommy Thompson within weeks after the September 11th hijackings and the ensuing anthrax attacks. Skipping down. Critics of the CDC proposal, however, say it threatens to create a public health, quote, police state, unquote, that could spur people to panic and flee, helping to spread deadly germs farther afield. Quote, This law treats American citizens as if they are the enemy, unquote, said George Annis, chairman of the Health Law Department at the Boston University School of Public Health. Skipping down further, civil rights protections are exactly what opponents find lacking. This is in the CDC proposal. The kind of public health emergency that would trigger extraordinary powers for health officers is defined so broadly that it could include AIDS, HIV infection, or a severe flu epidemic, said Tanya Ehrman, director of public policy at the activist group AIDS Action in Washington, D.C. Anna said that under the legislation, people could be detained without a court order and isolated in stadiums or clinics without an adequate process to challenge the decision. The proposed law would also shield officers from liability, along with anyone working at their direction, for deaths or health damage suffered by quarantined bioterror victims, he said. Under the measure, quote, If you kill people or hurt them, that's tough, said Annis, one of 10 New England health law scholars urging Thompson to change the draft law. Quote, The families can't sue, nobody can sue, unquote. Joanne Husted, senior counsel at the Health Privacy Project at Georgetown University, said the CDC proposal is an important effort to strengthen public health laws. But she said the broad definition of a health emergency would allow the collection and sharing of protected private health information under circumstances that don't involve bioterrorism. Now, in this context, and in the context of Serpent's Walk, we're going to listen to some excerpts of For the Record program number 271, recorded on January 21st of 2001. This is about Attorney General Ashcroft and some of his interesting liaisons. First of all, he has gone to bat for the neo-Confederate movement, which, as we looked at and among other programs, For the Record broadcast 196, has strong links to, among other elements, the Aryan Nations and the Holocaust denial movement. This is from For the Record program number 271. There was a column about Ashcroft's nomination in the New York Times of Thursday, January 18th of the year 2001. This column is by Bob Herbert. It's titled Unseemly Alliances. And of Ashcroft's nomination, we read, skipping down, "The Senate may confirm Mr. Ashcroft, but nothing will change the fact that his nomination is a slap in the face for those who feel strongly about racial justice. He fought like someone possessed against all efforts to desegregate the public schools in and around St. Louis when he was Attorney General and then Governor of Missouri. And he spoke glowingly of Southern Partisan Quarterly Review, a gruesomely racist magazine. As the watchdog publication Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, or FAIR, has said, quote, when Attorney General nominee John Ashcroft praised the neo-Confederate magazine Southern Partisan, he was endorsing a publication that defends slavery, white separatism, apartheid, and David Duke, unquote. Southern Partisan is a sick magazine. It giddily celebrates the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. Joyful references to his murder can be found in issue after issue. Of John Wilkes Booth, one writer said, quote, his behavior was not only sane but sensible, unquote. Another writer referred to the Emancipation Proclamation as, quote, an invitation to the slaves to rise up against their masters, unquote. Leaders of the Ku Klux Klan are praised, and a wide range of ethnic groups are slurred. One contributor wrote, quote, as the genetic racial pool in the United States from which the Democratic government originally derived is dissipated in successive tides of immigration, our country is being overwhelmed, unquote. So what does John Ashcroft have to say about this publication? I quote, your magazine also helps set the record straight. You've got a heritage of doing that, of defending Southern patriots like Robert E. Lee, Stonewall Jackson, and the Confederate President Jefferson Davis. Traditionalists must do more. I've got to do more. We've all got to stand up in this respect, or else we'll be taught that these people were giving their lives, subscribing their sacred fortunes and their honor to some perverted agenda, unquote. That agenda, by the way, would be slavery, and there are those who would claim that that is indeed a perverted agenda, and I would be among them. Continuing with Barb Herbert's column, questions about Bob Jones, that's the head of Bob Jones University, an openly racist university in the South where Ashcroft once spoke. Questions about Bob Jones and Southern Partisan came up at Mr. Ashcroft's confirmation hearing yesterday. He said he rejected racial and religious intolerance. But the man who should be called to account for this appallingly divisive nomination is George W. Bush, whose inaugural festivities get underway today at the Lincoln Memorial. Also in For the Record program 271, we talked about Ashcroft's support for a Dr. Sell, a right-wing extremist who could be accurately described as a terrorist. The following is from the New York Observer of January 18th of the year 2001. This was authored by Joe Conason, C-O-N-A-S-O-N. It's titled, Why Did Ashcroft Try to Help Dr. Sell? That's S-E-L-L, and it reads as follows. During his long political career, tough John Ashcroft has rarely, if ever, spoken out on behalf of the rights of criminal defendants. He carried out 7 executions as the governor of Missouri. In the Senate, he supported fewer protections for death row inmates as well as harsher penalties for juvenile offenders. He opposes expanded treatment for drug offenders. Last year, he fiercely and successfully opposed the nomination of Ronnie White to a federal judgeship, because the black jurist is supposedly pro-criminal, unquote. But there's at least one criminal defendant for whom Mr. Ashcroft, now awaiting confirmation as U.S. Attorney General, has demonstrated real concern. That would be Dr. Charles T. Sell, a St. Louis dentist indicted by the Justice Department on charges that include conspiracy to murder an FBI agent and a federal witness. The strange case of Dr. Sell, imprisoned for much of the past 3 years in the psychiatric ward of the federal prison in Springfield, Missouri, began in May of 1997 when he was arrested in his office by federal agents on charges of defrauding Medicaid. A year later, the government charged the dentist and his wife, Mary Sell, with plotting to kill the FBI agent who arrested him, as well as a former employee who was the chief witness against him. The evidence includes taped conversations described as incriminating by a St. Louis Post-Dispatch reporter who listened to them and statements by a couple who say the cells tried to hire them to carry out the murders. While serving as a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Mr. Ashcroft made several inquiries to the Justice Department on behalf of the dentist, according to Gordon Baum, head of the Council of Conservative Citizens, a militant white racialist group headquartered in Missouri, and the Post-Dispatch. As recently as last September, while he campaigned for re-election to the Senate, Mr. Ashcroft met personally with a prominent CCC member named Thomas Bugle to discuss how he could assist Dr. Sell. The case has remained in legal limbo since 1998 because federal authorities believe Dr. Sell is mentally ill and therefore unfit to stand trial. While incarcerated, he has refused to take antipsychotic drugs prescribed by a government psychiatrist. He believes that the Clinton administration is persecuting him because, as an Army Reserve officer, he criticized the government's conduct during the Branch Davidian siege in Waco, Texas. Federal prosecutors have declined to comment on the case, but his prosecution and imprisonment have become a cause célèbre among leaders of the CCC. Mr. Baum, who resides near St. Louis, confirmed that Dr. Sell has been a staunch CCC member. He advertised his dental services on Mr. Baum's radio program, and as a long friend and former patient, Mr. Baum added that he firmly believes in the accused dentist's professed innocence. Quote, "We as an organization have never made any efforts to be involved in Dr. Sell's plight," insisted Mr. Baum, who gained notoriety briefly in 1998 following media reports about Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott's involvement with the CCC's Mississippi chapter. He said he doubted that Mr. Ashcroft's assistance to Dr. Sell had anything to do with his CCC connections, unquote. Or, quote, "Everything has been done by individuals, and they probably kept the CCC out of it," he said. Yet reports about the case appear on the CCC website, where Mr. Ashcroft's nomination as Attorney General was recently lauded because of hopes that he will free Dr. Sell. And again, Ashcroft has been very, very active on behalf of Dr. Sell, who was plotting to murder, according to credible sources, an FBI agent who arrested him and a federal witness. That again from For the Record program number 271, streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery, also available from Spitfire. There was a very alarming recent disappearance of a Harvard professor who was an expert on the immune system and deadly viruses. I would note that there is a, in part, Bin Laden family capitalized biotechnology firm in Cambridge. Whether or not there's any connection here, I don't know. I would also note that the Boston area was the epicenter for the American operations of the Bin Laden family, and that both planes that crashed into the World Trade Center took off from Logan Airport. In that context, consider the following. This is from the New York Times of Tuesday, November 27th of the year 2001. It's an article by Fox Butterfield, Dateline Boston, headlined, "Harvard Professor's Disappearance Baffles." The disappearance of a prominent Harvard biochemist in Memphis earlier this month has baffled his family, friends, and law enforcement. But because the professor, Don C. Wiley, is a leading expert on dangerous viruses like Ebola, the mystery of his disappearance has provoked wider attention as well. Professor Wiley, 57, has been missing since early November 16th when the police found his rental car abandoned on a bridge over the Mississippi River outside Memphis. Skipping down, speaking of his wife, Ms. Valgiers Dotier was at Logan International Airport at Boston on November 16th, heading with her children to Memphis, where her husband had arranged to pick them up at the airport later that day. She received a cell phone call telling her that his rental car had been found at 4 a.m. on the Hernando de Soto Bridge, which connects Memphis with Arkansas. The keys were still in the ignition, the gas tank was full, and the car, a white Mitsubishi Gallant, was blocking truck traffic. So just what exactly happened to Professor Wiley was whether there's another explanation or whether he was perhaps kidnapped by foreign terrorists. Bear in mind that his place of residence and work was the epicenter for the American operations of the Bin Laden family. Bear in mind also that domestic terrorists are part of the underground Reich and also connected with John Ashcroft. In that context, let's close with an excerpt from a book called Blood Oath, co-authored by Stephen Wirth and Carl Jaspers. The book is subtitled A Conspiracy to Murder Nicole Brown Simpson, published in softcover by Rainbow Books and copyright 1996. Utilizing information from an informant who used the code name Skinner, the authors, who believe that the book is largely accurate but with some deliberate disinformation, deals with a white supremacist plot to murder Ron Goldman and Nicole Brown Simpson and to frame O.J. This group involved white supremacists both inside the LAPD and outside. This group, described as CAUSE, Christian Aryan Underground Special Enforcers, was evolved from the Order, the Nazi terror group from the 1980s that used the Turner Diaries, also published by National Vanguard Books, as a blueprint, and that the conspiracy to called Operation Thunderbolt was timed to celebrate the murder of Alan Berg by the Order and was connected to the bombing of Oklahoma City. As we saw in For the Record program 336, Timothy McVeigh was spotted by many witnesses in combination or in the company of many Middle Eastern men. Of a McVeigh associate named Stephen Garrett Colburn, who may have helped to plant O.J.'s blood at the site of the murders. And again, this is speculative, but the connection between Stephen Colburn and the white supremacist movement and Timothy McVeigh is solid. And note his occupation. Just as the Oklahoma bombing was the catalyst for our informant coming forward, coincidentally, it was also the catalyst for the arrest of Stephen Garrett Colburn, 35, alias Bill Carson. Colburn had been employed as a DNA research associate at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center from mid-1993 through October of 1994. It was during that time that O.J. Simpson had surgery there. Colburn was arrested by federal marshals on Friday, May 12th of 1995. Colburn is known to have expressed pro-Nazi sympathies with references to the Third Reich and was extremely anti-Semitic. He held a hatred of women, Mexicans, and non-whites alike. U.S. Marshals described Colburn as armed, dangerous, and trained in survival skills. When arrested in Oatman, Arizona, he kicked a marshal in the jaw and attempted to reach for a gun and knife in his back pocket. The trailer he lived in was searched and revealed several cases of ammunition, including cases holding link belt rounds for machine guns, along with cases of handgun and rifle bullets. Colburn admitted knowing Timothy McVeigh, the accused Oklahoma City bomber. Skipping down, the agents also discovered stolen medical supplies and, quote, some very interesting paperwork, unquote. That's in connection with an earlier arrest in 1993 to blow up a church. This concludes For the Record program number 339, Walking the Snake Part 4, Ashcroft Uber Alles. This has been recorded on December 2nd of the year 2001. And again, if some of the references, such as the discussion of Blood Oath, seem obscure, the other broadcasts, the For the Record programs and other programs are available from Spitfire, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Email mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. Visit their website at www.spitfirelist.com. WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey, is compiling the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs, are streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery. Older programs are available for download only, including the vast majority of the For the Record programs. There is a link on both the For the Record section of the Spitfire website and the WFMU.org/Dave Emery website of WFMU. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.